I'd like to turn the program over to our editor-in-chief, Tim Clark. Tim, it's all yours.
Thank you very much, Andrea, and let me add my welcome to all of you, and especially to our distinguished panelists. We are very excited to have this panel of deputy secretaries of major departments, Seth Harris from the Labor Department, Kathleen Merrigan from the Department of Agriculture, and Scott Gould from the Department of Veterans Affairs. These are people who are, as our, the title of our session today suggests, at the front lines of reform. There's a lot of talk of reform around Washington these days, and as Seth was observing before breakfast, people think of reform as being now huge reforms like health care reform and cap and trade and other major policy changes that are being pursued from the White House. But there are many, many other aspects of reform that are going on in the departments and agencies, and they have to do with the working conditions, the programmatic management, and other aspects of departmental operations. And so this is at the core of what government executive is really interested in. We think it's at the core of what you out there in the audience, federal officials who have to work in these departments, who are privileged to work and enjoy working in these departments, are interested in. So here's the deal. We have asked each of our panelists to talk for 7 minutes, and they can go six if they want to, about what are the core issues of reform, what are the new priorities, if you will, both on the policy and management fronts that they are pursuing. And we have, of course, a changeover in administrations, and therefore a whole new look being brought to the operations, the programs of these major agencies. And then after we've done that, we're going to address a common, we're going to try to bring out common themes, management themes, such as staffing, budget, technology, outsourcing and insourcing, performance measurement, and other items that have been, that I think are of wide interest throughout the government, and we'd be happy to take your questions then. Let me quickly introduce our panel. Now, we're going to go alphabetically, I was told by someone. I had thought ladies first, but I'm not in control here. So, but I am in control of the introduction, so I'm going to introduce the Honorable Dr. Kathleen A. Merrigan, first Deputy Secretary of the Department of Agriculture. I was talking with her at breakfast, and I was excited to learn, reading about her career, that she'd spent the last 8 years at Tufts University, which I know well. My son went there, and it's a terrific organization. I'm in school, and a terrific organization within the school is the Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy. It's the top such operation in the country, and she spent 8 years teaching there. At the same time, she's been an expert consultant of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN in Rome. She was, in a sense, in exile for the last 8 years, although she liked it at Tufts, because she had been in the Clinton administration, administrator of the Agriculture Marketing Service for 2 or 3 years. She served on the Hill. She has a long interest in agricultural policy. So welcome to Kathleen. Next, are we going back to, now we're going alphabetical, Scott Gould, Deputy Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs, the second largest department, as you know, responsible for a wide variety of health care services, benefits programs, national cemeteries, and, as I say, second largest department in Washington, as I guess is measured by employment. Is that right, Scott? Scott has served in, also served in the government earlier as Chief Financial Officer and Assistant Secretary for Administration at the Commerce Department, and also in financial management positions at the Treasury Department. He got his start as a White House Fellow. He's a veteran of the U.S. Navy, having served at sea aboard the guided missile destroyer Richard Byrd, and is a reservist who was called up to active duty in Operation Noble Eagle and Enduring Freedom. Scott's a fellow of the National Academy of Public Administration, and let me mention, and by way of mentioning that, welcome NAPA President Jenna Dorn, who's with us here today. Now to Seth Harris. Seth is sitting to my left, and it was really at his initiative, and thank you very much, Seth, that we got this program going here, and he helped us reach out to others. Seth is joined the Labor Department as Deputy Secretary after working as an agency group leader during the transition. He came to the Department of Labor from New York Law School, where he was a professor and the director of the school's Labor and Employment Law Program. He spent nearly 7 years in the Clinton administration as a senior advisor on labor management and strategy issues for two labor secretaries. He is, among other things, a strong proponent of flexible work arrangements. So welcome to you, Seth, and thank you again for helping get this organized. And the principle of, and we're going back to alphabetical, I'm going to ask Scott to give us his take on what are the key issues that he sees at the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Great, Tim. Thank you very much, and thank you for all you do. Government Executive Magazine, great resource, and you really have your hand on the pulse of what's going on here in D.C. I now have the answer to the question of how I got here. Seth actually called, and generally when Seth calls, I'll say yes, but he had proposed we found a new law firm, Merrigan, Harris, and Gould. And so here we are this morning, and I now find out what I need to speak to. I had a good friend welcome me on board when I was first confirmed as deputy secretary, and they said, "Welcome to accelerated aging." And boy, that is the feel of these jobs, let me tell you. I thought I would do three things this morning. And number one, describe the role of chief operating officer as deputy secretary at the VA. They are each unique across the agencies, not only in mission, but in the role that our secretaries ask us to play. And then I'll just lay out at a very high level some of the priorities for VA itself. And lastly, in the spirit of the dispatch from the front lines of reform, I'll give you a half a dozen or so kind of quick impressions about what it's like to serve in these roles and what I think our organizations are going through. So the role of the COO, the deputy secretary of the VA is very much in the chain of command, secretary, deputy secretary, and then the operating units. We have two principal jobs. The first is to synchronize the activities of the organization. We are one VA, but we have three different operational units. And it is often challenging to be able to deliver services on health care, on cemetery, and on Veterans Benefits Administration as an integrated whole. Our belief is that our customer approaches the VA just wanting services. They don't want to be told they have to go to three different administrations. It'll be interesting to see whether Seth and others have that same impression of needing to create a single pathway for our customers to obtain products and services from our agency. The second is to try to keep our team distributed around the ball. I'll use a soccer term. Those of you who are fans of the sport, as I am, appreciate that great teams don't all play the ball. They play their position. And so what we try to do with the VA, particularly among the top team, is make sure we're not all crowding the issue of the day. That urgent and compelling request from the White House, the frontline article in the Washington Post that you pick up, there's a tendency for the team to go there. It's where the heat and the action is. You can create a lot of impression of making progress, but our view is that really good teams play their position and are moving forward on the secretary's agenda as the day goes forward, almost independently of that frenetic activity going on in the chief of staff's office. So what are our priorities? The priorities at VA are, first and foremost, to change what we regard as an adversarial relationship into one of advocating on the part of veterans. And that simple mindset driven through all of the services that we provide is very much the raison d'etre for our team. We are trying to embed three specific values or principles into all that we do. The first is a people-centered approach. You'll hear Secretary Shinseki talk a lot about the need to invest in our career civil service, the need to build our career teams, and also to think about people in terms of the clients that we serve, the 23 million veterans in America who have a right, who have earned an entitlement to health care and benefits across a wide range of services. And then second is a results-oriented approach. We're in this to create a benefit for the public and for our veterans, and so results that are measurable, that are time-phased and specific are very much on our agenda. And finally, a future orientation. We're building an enormous structure for a future that's 20, 25, 30 years away. We care today for veterans who fought in World War II in Korea. You know, they're in their 80s now, and it's the same VA that's been taking care of them all along. What are we doing to prepare for the 20-year-old that lost a limb, lost their vision, lost hearing at age 19 or 20 when they are age 80 or age 85? So finally, the dispatch from the front line. So what's it like? What's the experience in the deputy role? The first is obviously an enormous challenge of scope and scale. Quick stats on the VA. Tim touched on a few of them. 288,000 W-2s that we send out every 2 weeks. We issue 1 million benefit checks every 2 weeks. We essentially bury 113,000 people a year. We care for 5.6 million veterans who are regular occupants of our hospitals and clinics across the country. We are a very large organization. We are the largest direct health care system in America. We are the sixth largest insurance company in the country with $1.3 trillion worth of face value. So it's very large, and what that does is it drives you to a role in which the scope and scale of the organization prevents you, in most instances, from having daily contact with people on the front line. So action at a distance is the challenge that we all face. The second is the enormous compression of the strategic management cycle itself. All of us who have run organizations before or been in government wish that we had the luxury of first establishing a vision, building a strategy, translating that into financial terms, developing our operating plans, and kind of moving forward. Kathleen and Seth and I did not have that luxury. All right? What we had to do is we kind of airdropped into the process, and someone said, you know, your 2010 budget, it's due in 4 weeks. What would you like to change? What quick priorities? And you don't really get a chance to pop the hood and get under that until you're dealing with the 2011 budget process or 2012. We have already picked most of the senior management team we will have for 4 years. We have already made most of the financial bets that we will make for the next three. And we have initiated the principal relationships that will define how effective we are in government already. White House, the Hill, our own teams, our own career personnel. Decision-making. We do it every day under conditions of uncertainty and ambiguity. The number of times I've had to make a decision without the slide deck, without that key piece of data, without the study and analysis completed in advance, it's happening a lot. We want to have it happen less as part of the staff function in the VA. We're going to get better at that. But these decisions come along, you've got to make them. That's a common experience. There is frequently a mismatch between your need and the skills available. Skills available. I believe that somewhere in the organization is the individual with the talent and the capability and the passion to do a really great job at what I need tomorrow, but being able to find them is an extraordinary challenge. The number of times I've found that individual in an elevator, in a hallway, or in a frontline visit's amazing. Just trying to make that connection. Marcel just came up to me and introduced herself today, right? She's on the policy team. I hadn't had a chance to meet her before. She said, hey, I want to introduce myself. I'm on the VA team. Thank you for doing that. In those small ways and by 100 paths, you ultimately have that initial relationship that allows you to say, gosh, there's somebody else that I know perhaps I could turn to for some help. We do a lot of listening, and we do a lot of asking for help in our roles. Two more quick things. We are translating. We moved from the campaign to governance, very different. We have moved already principally from strategies to tasks. By October 1st, 4 weeks away, I have 83 separate operating plans that are ready to go with dollars and senior execs assigned to them. I had 4 weeks to complete that cycle. We left the strategy, thinking about what you're going to do in 2010, now months ago, translating into that accelerated aging model years ago, in terms of our experience. So it's all happening very quickly. And then lastly, we're moving from team building to execution. You all have heard that model, forming, storming, norming, performing. It's very much happening in accelerated rate on the senior political team and with the career team. And so we're at the point now where we have to perform. We've got to execute. The last piece I'd touch on, a common experience velocity. There's a lot that we're doing very, very fast. My briefing binder, it's about 100, 150 pages a night. It includes the secretary's briefing binder and my chief of staff. We all read each other's documents. So we come in, and in the morning, I pop my head into the chief, and I go, "Chief, how about that meeting? I'm not going, but I can give my input." Similarly, he can do the same for me. But to be able to do the studying, to keep up with 10 hours of office time, and then go do the reading and make the calls and prep and be ready to go the next morning is a sporty course, as they say. So there it is. Quick roll, the COO, some priorities that we have at VA about changing who and what we are. Advocacy is the key concept there. And then a couple of takeaways and experiences that I'm having as COO of the VA. I look forward to learning from Seth and Kathleen.
Seth, you're next.
Thanks a lot, Tim. Thanks to Government Executive. Thanks to my friends Scott and Kathleen. Every time I talk to them, I learn something, and there was no exception. I was taking notes on what Scott had to say. I wanted to start by talking about one of the things that surprised me when I returned to the Labor Department after 6 years in Clinton, and I too was in exile, and I returned in this role. I was surprised to find that the Labor Department employs a dog, not a metaphorical dog, and I'm not using an acronym, actually a pooch. She's a bomb-sniffing dog, but she only sniffs for 8 hours a day, apparently on the theory that terrorists don't work overtime. I don't know. We also have a car. We lease a car for tens of thousands of dollars a year that drives back and forth on the 200 yards of I-395 that goes underneath our building, also apparently looking for bombs, also working only 8 hours a day. So needless to say, we're eliminating the dog program and the car program in our next budget. And I mention them not because I think that they're illustrative of or the tip of the iceberg of dozens and dozens and dozens of wasteful programs that can be easily washed away, but because I view them as really exceptional cases. One of the things that I found in moving into the COO role is there's not a lot of obvious waste or programs that would make an audience full of people laugh that you can wipe away and call it reform. We did eliminate an unnecessary layer of bureaucracy called the Employment Standards Administration. That's a million-dollar organization that really just added very little value to the leadership of the organization, and we've done some other sort of quick and dirty reform moves. You know, you don't get both a desktop and a laptop and sort of straightforward things like that. But most of our reform efforts at the Labor Department are what I would call values-driven reforms. And Scott's use of the word values, I think, was very important and picked up on a meta theme that's very important at the Labor Department. We have the starting place for our discussion about how do we want to reform the Labor Department is what do we do? What business are we in? I think that a lot of people, anybody who's familiar with the Labor Department, could list off the functions of the Labor Department but really couldn't say what business we're in, what job we have, what our role is. And so Secretary Solis laid out a vision for the department, and that is that we are the department of good jobs for everyone. Our job is to create good jobs or help to create good jobs for everyone. And then we populated that idea by listing a set of outcomes that are necessary to have good jobs. You have to have rising wages. You have to have skills and knowledge for workers. You have to have safe and healthy workplaces, fair and diverse workplaces, voice in the workplace. It's a list of about 13 outcomes. And then we frankly turned to our agencies and said to our agencies, okay, which of these do you own? Which of these outcomes are you going to produce? Not alone, necessarily, but what are you going to produce? Because like VA, although we have a larger number of agencies, not as many bodies, but a larger number of agencies, we're a sort of a federation of organizations, and we want them to understand that it's a shared responsibility, but that they have to take ownership for a particular outcome. And then what we said to them is, and this has just been in the last few weeks, we said to them is, if you are engaged in an activity that is directly designed to achieve one of those outcomes, do it and do it better, and we're going to work with you in figuring out how to do it better. If you're engaged in an activity that's not about producing those outcomes, stop. Don't do it anymore. Don't do it anymore. And we've had some very tough discussions about what it is that they're supposed to be producing. So the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, the Mine Safety and Health Administration, they own safe and healthy workplaces along with some other organizations. The Employment and Training Administration, the Veterans Employment and Training Administration, they own rising wages, skills and knowledge, and other outcomes together. So that is, for us, values-driven reform. And it gives us a sort of a North Star to follow in deciding what choices we're going to make, because it's not as easy as getting rid of the dog who only works 8 hours a day. I wanted to highlight a few of the things that we are doing that we would qualify as values-driven reform that, like Scott, focus on a trinity of large programs inside the organization. We essentially are an organization that does three things. One is workforce development, which is job training and skills development and job placement and job matching. We are a large, like Scott, we are a large benefits organization. We run workers' compensation programs of varying sorts. And we are a worker protection organization. We enforce a long list of employment laws. I don't know if it's designed to be a trinity in every case, but it happens to be in our case as well, Scott. So how are we reforming this multi-billion-dollar workforce investment system that we run? And its job is to help workers find jobs and get the skills they need in order to get into jobs, hopefully with rising wages, using a network of one-stop centers around the country, bricks-and-mortar one-stop centers. So one of the things that we're doing is we're moving to Workforce System 2.0. Moving to virtual one-stop centers, moving to a distance learning model in some cases, using web-crawling spiders to help find the good jobs that are out there and to make it easier for workers to find those jobs. At the same time, we're improving service delivery in our bricks-and-mortar one-stop centers and associated job training programs. A very, very high priority at OMB is evaluation. And it's a very high priority at the Labor Department as well. You cannot know whether or not you are producing good outcomes for workers unless you evaluate the outcomes of the programs. So we have put a tremendous emphasis into building up, bulking up our evaluation systems, both inside the Employment and Training Administration, but also department-wide, a very high priority for us. We've used funding that we got from Congress as part of the Recovery Act, and I know we're going to talk about the Recovery Act shortly, Tim. We've used money that we got to train people for green jobs, not merely for direct training, but to green our entire system, to move the system to focus on the jobs of the future rather than continuing to focus on the jobs that are in front of them today. And we're creating career pathways so that wherever the customer is located, we can bring them to a middle-class job without having to worry about what, as Scott was saying, what the name of the program is, what organization runs the program, is it the Education Department, is it the Labor Department, is it HHS. They should be able to look at a map and know how to get to their endpoint without having to figure out our systems. They should be able to get there based on what they need, a needs-based system. And we're including, and this is a high priority for Secretary Solis, we're including service providers in underserved populations that have been excluded for many years. It's a reform in our system, particularly compared with the last 8 years, to focus on the workers who need the help the most. That hasn't been the priority, the value-driven priority of the last 8 years. We're changing that. In worker protection, we've given our agencies a set of 14 strategic principles that we want them to at least consider adopting in achieving the outcomes that they're asked to achieve. I'll give you an example of some of those. We want them to focus on corporate-wide enforcement, right? Not just one-offs at a particular establishment of a Burger King. We want them to go after the whole Burger King franchise if Burger King itself is responsible for the bad outcomes in a particular place. We're going to use social networking tools and other information technology innovations that are going to make our enforcement efforts both more transparent and a lot more effective than they have been. We're going to regulate the hazards that pose the greatest risks. You would think that that would be just inherent in what we do. It's not. We're not going to just regulate to regulate. We're going to regulate to actually save people's lives. And at the same time, focus on the most vulnerable population, the most egregious employers, and the strategies that are going to produce the highest level of compliance. And then third, I just wanted to mention we're reforming how the department does business as a whole. I could go into an extended discussion of workers' compensation, but it'll get so complicated I'm afraid I'll lose you. So I'll just talk about how we're reforming the department as a whole. One of the hallmarks of the Obama administration is open government, transparency and open government. So we have an open government initiative at the Labor Department, and we are quite serious about involving the American people in the decision-making of the Labor Department. We're going to give them access to information about employers who violate every law that we enforce so that they can make decisions based on that. We're not going to tell them, don't go to work for these folks, but we're going to give them the information they can use so that they can make a decision about what they're going to do in dealing with these employers themselves. We're going to involve them in our grant-making decisions. Right? We're going to make grant applications available to the public so that they can offer their opinions. We're going to use social reputation software in order to be able to do that. We're going to create a new position of a chief evaluation officer. I've told you evaluation is a very high priority for us. We're going to create a chief evaluation officer and have an evaluation office in our policy office that is going to lead a strategic approach to evaluation in all of our agencies. You know, we are doing one-off evaluations that don't necessarily lead to one another right now, don't have a plan. Now we're going to get a plan. We're going to have folks who can help to design evaluations that give us a system of continuous improvement. And this is something I know Tim wants to talk about, we've started insourcing, right? The push of the last 8 years was outsourcing. We're insourcing, and we're finding that it's saving a tremendous amount of money. So where we can, we are transforming contractors into federal employees. So that's just sort of a tip of the iceberg of what we're doing in reform at the Labor Department, and looking forward to hearing more from Kathleen and Scott about what they're doing as well so I can steal their ideas.
Thank you very much, Seth. That was a... long and a comprehensive list. couldn't take notes, it was so fast, but anyway. that's great. Thank you. Kathleen, your turn.
Thank you. Good morning. We started out in this administration at USDA by spending a lot of time thinking about what our priorities are. We're 114,000 employees, 90% of our employees are out in the field. With the ARRA funding, the Recovery Act funding, we're about $130 billion department. There's a lot of moving parts, but what are our priorities? What are we going to hold ourselves accountable for at the end of this administration? This kicked off the secretary and his senior people coming up with a list of priorities. We vetted them through our sub-cabinet and our agency administrators through several days of meetings led by the secretary and myself. And ultimately, we came down to four priorities. I'll tell you what they are, because this is what we're going to be all about in the next 4 years. Our first priority is that USDA will assist rural communities to create wealth so they are self-sustaining, repopulating, and economically thriving. And some of you may have followed the secretary and other cabinet members have been on a pretty aggressive rural tour in this administration, going around the countryside, listening to people in rural America to hear about the problems they're facing and trying to come up with solutions that we can help them with. Second, USDA will ensure our national forests and private working lands enhance our water resources and are conserved, restored, and made more resilient to climate change. Third, USDA will help America promote sustainable ag production and biotech exports as America works to increase food security. And finally, USDA will ensure that all of America's children have access to safe, nutritious, and balanced meals. Okay, the panic is, what if you don't see yourself in one of those priorities, right? Because we have a lot of constituencies, we have a lot of programs. These are what we're going to hold ourselves accountable to, and we needed to develop these priorities in order to go into our budget process, which is a common feature across deputies in the government, right? We sort of lead the budget process, and so that was what I was in charge with. And so once we had our priorities, we decided to do our budget process for FY11 a little bit differently than had been done in the past. We didn't have agencies come up with their budgets or mission areas. We did it by these four priorities. So instead of an undersecretary and their team coming up to my office and to the secretary saying, this is what we need, and assuming that last year's numbers are somewhat of an entitlement and we'd be engaged in a discussion about a little bit more or a little bit less, what we did was we had, in the secretary's conference room, all of the undersecretaries come around the table by priority one, by priority two, by priority three, by priority four. And the secretary and I said, okay, we need to show some results in 4 years on these priorities. We're going shopping. You're the salespeople. Give it your best shot, and we'll decide what we're going to buy. And we may buy a little bit more over in this mission area and a little bit less in this area because we want to achieve these priorities. So that's what we did, and it's really quite interesting. So all of the mission areas, ultimately, because of the kind of document we need to provide OMB and more specifically the kind of constraints put on us by Congress, ultimately, we do have still a mission area submission at the end of the game, but they also had to code everything by priorities. And so the Secretary and I could look across the span of programs that we have and see, is this going to be enough for these things that we need to deliver? The best part in this first year, and I think this is going to take some time to ultimately get to the deep reform that we want to achieve at the department, but what was really interesting was people around the table realizing they're doing some of the same functions in these different silos and saying, you do that? Well, we do that. And it really caused a lot of meetings across mission areas. You know, they come out, they're a little shaken in the meeting with the Secretary and myself, and it spawned so many meetings and a discussion about synergies. And when the FY11 budget request finally came in, there'd be little pieces of monies in different pots with agency descriptions about how they were going to collaborate with these other agencies in the department in ways that they had never constructed before. So we thought that was a really positive value. We were also asked by OMB, all of us, to put in high priority performance goals. And as Seth said, we are also very, very concerned about metrics. How are we going to measure our success on these priorities? And when we submitted metrics to OMB, one of my criteria for among my criteria for these metrics was that we wouldn't submit anything that didn't tap a number of agencies across different mission areas at USDA. Again, trying to break out of the silos. So that's a part of the reform effort that's going on USDA. Personnel is also something that's weighing heavily on my mind, and it certainly comes up in the budget process, right? Because everyone who comes up with a new idea and they want to be a salesperson, they say, here's my pitch. It's a really great idea, and I need 2,300 new staff years to accomplish it. I'm like, I got 114,000 people. You're crazy? And so when I was teaching at Tufts, I was doing some class on civil service, and I looked at OPM's website, and I was really caught by the federal retirement projections, and I asked for the disaggregated data for USDA by agency, and what we found is pretty much across the board within this administration, 50% of our employees are going to be retirement eligible, and OPM's assessment prior to the economic downturn was that 25% of, or, you know, half of those people would actually retire. Now, we know because of the economy, it's going to be somewhat less, but I'm really concerned about backfilling all these different jobs without going through an overall reassessment about where our staff years need to be in the future and how to realign with new priorities. And so we're in the midst of going through a process there, but essentially in the meantime, I'm holding the line on new staff years and trying to get agencies to figure out internally how to shift priorities around. When we go into this new budget cycle, we're spending a lot of time thinking about our eventual conversations with Congress. The Department of Agriculture probably has one of the most prescriptive appropriations bills in government. There was a man named Jamie Whitten who was the chair of the House Appropriations Committee for a lot of years, and he had a lot of ideas about agriculture, and you see that very realized in our appropriations, which is like tiny little programs, little accounts. It's just amazingly prescriptive. And as we go into the FY11 budget process, and one of the things we want to do is put a lot of new money in research and make our research agency more NSF or NIH-like than it has been in the past, we confront the issues around earmarking and about trust between USDA and the Congress. And so I have a strategy session after this meeting later this morning to talk about strategies on the Hill and how are we going to engage our legislators, our colleagues on the Hill, in a visioning process to get us out of this stalemate that we have. We spent all this time in the executive budget process, and it's just paper in the end. We really need to figure that one out. Last area of reform I'll just tick off. Some of you may know USDA has had a pretty sour history in civil rights over the years, and that is a high, high priority for the Secretary and myself to address wrongdoings in the past, and so that's taken up a lot of energy. It's also taken up a bunch of money, but we're intent on settling out old claims and making the work environment at USDA one that is welcoming of all and allows everybody to thrive and produce in the way that we all want to. So those are my opening comments, Tim.
Thank you very much, Kathleen. Let me follow up on one point here. Seth, I thought your department was all about jobs, and so I want to point out to you that you could have hired two new dogs and tripled the number of hours of the car going underneath the department and saved some jobs.
We haven't found doggy unemployment to be a major crisis just yet, but we're monitoring it closely.
Think of the trainers and so on. All right, let's start out by talking about, I'd like to ask a question of all of you about the financial crisis in this country and what it has done to how it affects how you treat your programs. All of you have constituencies that are in need, and most likely they're in greater need now than they were before in the last, you know, two or three years ago. Strikes me that that need has got to affect how you're treating, how you're considering what you're doing in your department. So, Seth, why don't you take a crack at that first, and then I'd like to hear from the others.
Sure. I think that's a critical point. The demand that pent up during 8 years from our constituents is really quite remarkable, and it is legitimate demand across a whole wide array of programs. Part of our challenge is to communicate to our constituents what is possible, not merely what is possible within the constraints of what is going to be in a tightening budget picture, but also what's possible organizationally. What we're trying to do is to structure our reform effort to respond to those legitimate pent-up demands of our constituents without it having added zeros to the budget. It's going to require a lot of creativity and a lot of leveraging of existing resources, particularly in the worker protection world, but also in the job training world. Partnerships, private sector partnerships, partnerships with state governments, partnerships with community colleges, which are an essential part of the workforce investment system, are going to be critical. I think that's a very important point. Our constituents, of course, don't just come to us. They go to Congress, and Congress sometimes responds with money. Sometimes they respond with mandates without money. It's part of an ongoing process of communicating how we best get to the outcomes that we've identified as part of Good Jobs for Everyone, given that there are a lot of stark limits placed on us. We had a flood of money, frankly, the Labor Department did at least a flood of money under the Recovery Act, and that money ends at the end of fiscal 2010. That spending ends, and we're going to recede back to where we were, a little bit higher. Our budget, we got a nice budget increase in fiscal 2010. There is no way we could get enough money that would meet all of those demands. So we have to be more creative and use reform as a means of achieving those results, as opposed to just spending more money.
Kathleen and Scott, both of you have served populations that are relatively low on the income scale. Must be difficult out there given the financial crisis that the country is experiencing. How do you think about it?
Sure. When I ask people, man on the street, what does USDA do? What does agriculture do? They say subsidies to farmers, right? That would be the common perception. Well, we're an everyday and every way department. There's hardly a function of the U.S. government that you can think of that doesn't happen in USDA. In fact, if you're in senior management, the federal government, we probably do your payroll. We do most of the federal payroll. There are all kinds of things that USDA does, and what might surprise you is that 60% of our dollars are actually going to nutrition program. So that's the biggest part of our portfolio. And in an economic downturn, a program like SNAP, which is the formerly known as food stamps, is a big part of the Recovery Act dollars for us. So on average, families are getting $80 more a month in recovery dollars in their SNAP benefits. And people say, where is that money going? That's one immediate thing. And we've found our economists say that for every dollar that we spend in SNAP benefits, you get $1.94 benefit in the community in terms of how money is spent. So that's a big part of it. But in terms of management challenges, I will say that we also had a lot of money in housing. USDA is a big player in the housing process. And some of the agencies have these inflated budgets, and they come, again, back to the FY11 budget process, and they want some sort of glide path out of this big recovery dollar. They're concerned because they've had this increase, this huge increase in their portfolio, that the dollars are going to go away, but they still have to manage it all. So that puts us in a bit of a bind because we can't grow the budget to capture the wave there, so to speak. That's a big challenge. The great thing about the Recovery Act, however, because our budget is so prescriptive, as I was describing from the Congress, this was a big pot of money that didn't have all the strings attached, and so we were able to fund a lot of conservation projects in particular that had been in the pipeline forever that really needed to be done, particularly around wastewater and water issues around the country. So it's been challenging, the good and the bad. The bad, again, is just how do we – what's the glide path out?
And very briefly, we also in the VA have considerable needs. Demand has increased. There's a quick statistic. The unemployment rate among our former military returning from Iraq and Afghanistan is twice the national average, so there's a real need there. We also have the problem of core medical inflation that continues to create that upward pressure. At the same time, we've been very fortunate. We had the largest budget increase in 30 years, thanks to the president's leadership and his focus on veterans. And what we're doing to address that issue is focusing on access, quality, and value. Like Seth, big focus on innovation, doing things differently. We call it Transformation 21. And the Secretary's favorite expression is more is not better, better is better. So we're looking for ways to make investments that actually drive our value up over the long run.
Let's keep on the budget for a second. I was interested to read in Secretary Shinseki's comments at the April strategic planning session that he considered that there was a window of opportunity, quote-unquote, for a budget opportunity now and that it needed to be seized, it needed to be pursued. In the Veterans Affairs Department, as you note, Scott, you had, I believe, a 15% increase in budget for 2010, right?
That's correct.
I don't know what the increases are in the other two departments here, but let's talk for just a second about what the budget outlook is. Two questions: has it been increasing so far in the Obama administration, and can those increases be sustained? And then, Scott, with your 15% increase, is that difficult to manage? I mean, that's a big increase in 1 year.
Yes, a couple of quick things. When I sat down with the president's nominee to become Secretary of the VA now about 9 months ago, we put a chart in front of him that had five boxes, box for the secretary, three boxes for my principal operating units, and a big rectangle underneath called management infrastructure. And we said, sir, let's color code this. Red in the office of the secretary, we're not doing this job right. Management infrastructure, significant problems. We don't have people and systems in place to spend the money. We put a lot of focus on making those two areas work, believing that we have fundamentally fairly well operating units. On the 15% figure, it's actually a blend of a 19% increase in mandatory spending and 11% of the discretionary side. So the piece we get to work with is 11%. It's still a lot. It's still tremendous. Our outlook for continuing that with my 11 budget still embargoed is best revealed in the advanced appropriation. Now, we do two-year budgeting now, at the VA that started last year, and there you will see an indicator of our future up 8.3%.
Kathleen?
Well, I come in with the belief that we needed the recovery dollars. They're doing some great things, especially for the people who are hardest hit, those people who use all of our nutrition programs, and we also do the school lunch and breakfast, and we expect that we'll see a significant uptick once we get all the data in from the beginning of the school year, because more families are suffering out there. We know this. But ultimately, I think within the time that we're here, we are going to be asked to make some difficult calls. And so that's, and again, another reason why I wanted to get this results-based budgeting put in place, so we're not focused on how do we cut that 10 or 15%, but rather focus on the 85, 90% that we really need. And so, again, I think that perspective in terms of organizing around priorities is going to become increasingly important as the years go on.
Yes, Sethi, you alluded to the tight budget climate, and picking up on what Kathleen said, you know, if you look out 3 years or during the first 4 years of the Obama administration, is it going to get significantly tighter, do you think, and how would you manage toward that?
Yeah, let me start by saying I want Scott's budget increases. 15 and 8 sounds pretty good to me. We had about an 8% increase in fiscal 2010 that we proposed. I think that Congress will probably end up giving us a little bit less than that, maybe in the 6.5 to 7% range. We don't have a final number yet. Maybe a little more. But it's going to get tighter now going forward. I think that there's little question that we're going to be focusing more on managing these massive deficits that we're facing. I can't, frankly, because we're still in dialogue with OMB about FY 2011, I can't really say what's ultimately going to happen, but I don't expect that we're going to be getting an 8% increase in the next year. I would expect that that funding going forward is going to be very tightly focused on particular projects that are designed to produce designated outcomes. So I think that the challenge for us, and this is one of the reasons I find Kathleen's approach to budgeting and Secretary Vilsack's approach to budgeting so appealing, is that the direct linkage of the additional funding to particular outcomes, particular priorities, I think is going ultimately as a tactical matter for me going to be the most effective way to go to the White House and make the case for the additional money. But I think it actually makes it an easier sales pitch to the American people. As we, one of the reasons that we try to articulate what business the Labor Department is in is, you know, we need to be able to sell these programs to the American people. We need to be able to sell spending this money on the American people. You know, to the American people. I think the American people understand when we put more money into unemployment insurance what that money is going for. But beyond that, I'm not really sure they can articulate what it is we do with the money that they give us. So we need to do a better job of that. Kathleen's budgeting process, this effort at identifying what constitutes a good job for everyone and how our agencies contribute to that, that's going to be key to the budget discussions going forward, even in what I think will be a fairly tight budget environment.
Can I jump in there, Tim, just to add something to what Seth said? Again, with the metrics that we're all working on, I think really important, the department has had metrics for years. They've had to submit these to OMB, and agencies are really anxious about submitting metrics that then they're held accountable to, so I'm always pushing them to be more aggressive. But among the criteria, again, in choosing these high-performance goals and the metrics that we want to add into USDA is I want it to meet the elevator test, right? So you go in the elevator and someone says, well, what's important? You need to be able to explain that to the person in the elevator. They understand by the time the ride's over. And a lot of the metrics that we were working with were just very, very technical, or they weren't something I could explain even to some people who are very much in the know. And so, again, how do we make ourselves accountable to the American people? That's important, and so that's part of the metrics challenge.
Yeah, that's one of the things that we've said in our management meetings, is that nobody voted for Barack Obama so that you guys would have more meetings. That's not a metric. They don't want to know how many times you guys drove down the road. They want to know how many people you saved from getting killed. And that's exactly the same process that we're in at the department.
Let me add to Kathleen's elevator test. I think there are three basic questions when you go to see an appropriator. What are you buying? How much does it cost? And what do I get for it? And if you can't answer that question in 30 seconds,
you're done.
On to the next line item.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Well, that brings up the question of Congress, and just let me ask you, it's notoriously resistant to change. I was telling Kathleen that 25 years ago I wrote a story about the Beekeeper's Indemnity Program, which they were trying to eliminate then. And, it was a tiny little program in the Agriculture Department, and it was under the axe, and I think it was the Carter administration. They couldn't get it done. Why? Because, the beekeepers are too powerful in Congress. So let me just ask quickly whether you think that Congress is amenable to the kinds of change. Do they care about metrics? They didn't care to give a damn about the metrics that the Bush administration produced. Is there a pretty good? How do you feel about that? On a scale of 1 to 10, what do you think? How receptive is Congress to these kinds of reforms? On a scale of 1 to 10, we'll go with you first, Scott.
Great. I think that the veterans' relationship with Congress is a little bit like foreign affairs was 20 or 30 years ago, where partisanship stopped at the water's edge. So what we see here are the eight corners very, very positively disposed to help veterans. So I'm going to go out on a limb on that scale of 1 to 10. I think we've got a 9. This is a Congress that's very, very focused on helping it. Give you a couple of quick examples. Number one, the budget itself looks like it's going through for 2010. We're in good shape, actually slightly plussed up, if you can believe that. And then secondly, we actually have members of Congress calling and saying, what is your legislative agenda? How can we help? What are your priorities? And, we're working together. So I'm very optimistic about that.
Great.
I would also give it a 9 as long as we have different conversations as well. In 1990, we passed a farm bill, and I was working on the Senate Agriculture Committee staff then, and I was really concerned that every year with earmarking, we were building this facility and that facility for ag research, and there wasn't an overall strategic plan for the process. And I actually, in the 90 farm bill, got Congress to hold off on earmarking for a while, and we passed a base closing facilities commission, akin to the military base closing commission. And actually, USDA started that process, but the end sort of chickened out. I think that if you put forward a very strong, compelling vision and you include your congressional colleagues in early on, they'll take leadership opportunities too, because they're completely aware of some of the same problems we are.
My answer is it depends. Partisanship most certainly does not stop at the water's edge for us. I think we live with it every day. But it depends on the programs. In the workforce investment world, we actually have very successful bipartisan relations. Senator Enzi, who's ranking on our authorizing committee in the Senate, is as passionate and thoughtful and engaged on Workforce Investment Act development and reauthorization as are any of the Democrats. And so there's, I think, a successful partnership. There are disagreements, but I think in that area, I would put it at an 8 or a 9. It's an area where there's been a lot of coming together and shared values. In the employment law arena, there is a lot less commonality. And so it depends. How successfully the department relates to Congress on those issues depends in part upon which party is in power. I've now had a few months under a Democratic majority regime, but I also was in the department in the middle and late 1990s when it was a Republican majority leading both houses. And frankly, it's a different relationship entirely. The relationship in the 90s was characterized by oversight and delay and great difficulty in getting anything enacted, and every appropriations bill was a battle. To now, there's a much more, many more shared values. There are disagreements about particular programs, and members have programs that they feel more strongly about than perhaps the numbers might suggest, but they are open to working with us in trying to figure out how best to do our job.
Well, that's an encouraging report. Let's turn to the topic of human capital for a minute. I'd be interested in hearing from you, how you think about your workforces and their needs. Are they up to 21st century standards? Are they trained right? If not, what needs to be done? Scott, you talked about, you've made what I consider to be, what seemed to be pretty dramatic, if that's the right word, statements about the workforce, you say, for example, that they need to be advocates, not adversaries, and you have said that there is a negative, if not toxic, work environment in some parts of your department. So let's start with you, and then maybe Kathleen and Seth on how you think about the human capital of your respective departments.
Personally, most important thing that Deputy Secretary, I think, can do for their organization is get it across to our people that we need to move from an environment where we talk about our career civil service as a cost and start thinking about them as an investment. I mean, this is a massive mistake that has been made for decades now of under-investing, under-training, under-supporting the career civil service. And the consequence of that is now being reaped as we come with these emergencies one after another, turning to the career team and asking people to step into the breach and do a great job under a lot of pressure. And what? Where's the training? Where's the education programs? Where's the career development been? As an example, in procurement, I have a 26% vacancy rate. I have an environment where you do train folks, they're gone in a year because they can and they should move to that next opportunity, that next job. So what we're doing is we will announce shortly what I believe is the largest single investment in career civil service in decades at the VA. It is a massive investment in training, in career development, in our people. And we have, in specific, created, for example, a new training academy at VA that's a three-year program that takes a GS-9 to a GS-13, a $30,000 pay increase, and year by year goes from theory and practice to mostly practice and a little bit of theory, classroom environment, cohort, and creates jobs for our career team.
So that's in the acquisition area, right? Scott?
Is yes, that
acquisition,
that's correct.
Right? Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No,
I'm sorry, I didn't mean
to
interrupt.
No, that's okay. That's enough. Get me started on that subject. That's very, very important.
Okay, so there's a new acquisition academy, right? That's the deal, yeah. Kathleen?
I think one of the things that we're hearing very much from our employees is that our IT systems are so out of date, so cumbersome, that their jobs are twice as hard as they need be. I remember 10 years ago, I was over in Japan at the Ministry of Agriculture there, and it was a time where we were all talking about the Japanese overtaking us and all the technology, and I remember going on this floor, and there were a couple of hundred people, and I didn't see one computer. I thought, how could that government be so behind where their industry is? And now I'm sort of looking at our own system and saying, maybe it's just a problem of government generally, but we are really behind in the IT curve, and that's demoralizing our people because they're not able to deliver services in the way that they want. As I said to you, 90% of our employees are outside of Washington. We're a field-based department, and they're dealing with people who are dealing with great trauma. We've had a number of dairy farmers, for example, commit suicide in the last few months because things are so hard out there. People are losing family farms that have been in the family for generations. And so if we are not giving them the tools that they need to do their job, they're there on the front line, they're confronting people, it's really, really tough. And so that's a high priority for us.
Well, I'm spending a sizable portion of my time talking about human capital right now because we're in the midst of hiring 3,000 people over six quarters, partly because of this budget increase that we got from Congress in fiscal 2010, almost entirely or largely in our worker protection agencies. So it's a tremendous opportunity. It also presents a lot of challenges. The greatest challenge is to use hiring as part of a reform effort. Not just to diversify the workforce, which is something that we desperately need, both age, ethnicity, sex, and disability and other criteria, but also to hire in a diverse way that best serves our mission. So if the Wage and Hour Administration is enforcing the Fair Labor Standards Act in Chinatown in New York City, they need Mandarin speakers, and they need people who understand that culture and can go in and have the kind of discussions you need to have in order to be able to enforce the law in that environment. So that's one of the challenges that we're facing. A second challenge that I personally look forward to and that Kathleen was referencing is when you hire a bunch of 20 and 30-somethings into an organization that has an average age over 50, you're going to change the culture of the organization whether you like it or not. I like it. Some of the other supervisors, frankly, may not like it. If you bring in a bunch of folks who grew up in a Starbucks culture, who want what they want when they want it in the way that they want it, and who are accustomed to using Facebook and Flickr and Twitter and know what those things are, not just know what they are, but they're an ordinary part of their lives, you're going to change the way you do business. You have no choice. The demand on your IT system is going to change. The way in which people conceive of the job is going to change. So the challenge is going to be to build career ladders for those folks and give them the training that they need in the organization without squeezing the joy out of them at the same time, which is a challenging government. But to give them career ladders and training that allows them to move up so that the reform doesn't get trapped in the front line, but the reform gets subsumed and absorbed into the organization and gets, frankly, co-opted into the organization and becomes a core of what you're doing. So I spend a lot of my time talking about this and thinking about this human capital challenge. I just want to echo what Scott said. Training of Labor Department personnel has been shortchanged every step of the way. And I would like to say it was just the last 8 years. It wasn't. It's been for decades. There has not been enough investment in the training of personnel. And a piece of that is, frankly, because we have not had a successful labor management partnership with our unions. And that's another thing that we have. When we talk about human capital challenges, we have to have successful relationships with the organizations that represent our workers. Those organizations need to be mission-focused, not just focused on whether or not the racquetball court stays open late, and get engaged in the work of the business, because our employees, I'm sorry to be filibustering, but obviously this is something I care a lot about, being the Labor Department. This is my last point is, the folks who work at the Labor Department share Secretary Solis's values. They didn't just apply to every federal agency and the Labor Department accepted their application first. Folks came to the Labor Department because they care about the mission of the Labor Department. They want to be helping workers. So getting them in the right place from a mission perspective, from a vision perspective, is not a challenge at all. They're there. But what they need is the tools, the skills, and the knowledge and the leadership that will allow them to succeed in their jobs. That's where we have to focus our emphasis now.
Okay. I'm going to have one follow-up question on this, and it has to do with culture change and directed specifically at you, Scott. You seem to have said that the Labor Department, the Veterans Affairs Department or elements of it, have an adversarial relationship with the constituencies they serve, and you want them to become more in the advocacy mode. Is that a culture change that is challenging? Is it a big problem? I guess it's developed over years, right? In the benefits programs particularly, but maybe you could talk for a second about that.
I'll give you a great example. We have a generation of Vietnam veterans who, 40 years after Vietnam, are still in a tug of war with the VA to determine whether they are entitled to benefits for Agent Orange. Now, how many people here think that's a reasonable amount of time to be working with your government to have recognized what is obviously a legacy of pain and suffering, physical pain and suffering and unbelievable diseases, cancers and so on? We're just an organization. We don't want to be having that conversation with the Gulf War folks of 20 years ago or with our Afghan, Iraq veterans in the future. And so what we want to do is change that equation to one of advocacy and support as opposed to an adversarial relationship where you prove it. Did you get that document from 40 years ago? You know, to how can we help you? And I think that's a mindset that our career team wants to make. But we have a set of rules and regulations and systems that embed and mandate that kind of relationship with VA. It's got to change.
Mm-hmm. Interesting and a challenging thing to get done. Still on the sort of human capital, in the human capital area, let's talk for a second about insourcing and outsourcing. It is thought, I think the White House has said, inherently, governmental jobs have been too often given over to contractors, and so there's a move afoot to bring some of those jobs back in. As I perceive it, it's a challenging deal. You've got existing contracts. You don't necessarily have the right people in the government to do some of these jobs. going beyond the inherently governmental, but how much of that is actually being done? And if each of you would give us perhaps one example of a type of job that you are actively working to insource, that would be interesting, I think.
Sure. I guess when I think about challenges, cultural challenges to the organization, to pick up on what Seth said, is all the activities which I put in the category of social media. This is stuff. I mean, I came from a graduate school. People interact, and the young people, there's just a totally different way. They don't read newspapers. They read online. They tweet. They blog. And they do all the stuff that I never thought would be a part of my life, but I'm making it so because I want to be an effective leader in the department. But we don't find that we have people within our ranks with those skills. And we don't necessarily have a mindset to take full advantage of the social media out there. And so we have been outsourcing some of that, and we need to build our own capacity within USDA because this is clearly the future. And if we want to be an everyday and every way department and reach new constituencies, it's absolutely crucial.
Thank you.
I want to basically, like I think in terms of personal integrity and honesty, since I came from a major systems integrator, IBM, before I came on board, do tend to see this in a balanced way. On the one hand, I believe there are things that the private sector does for government that it should do and it should continue to do. Examples include areas where we have capabilities, capacity, new technology, new knowledge that government needs. And frankly, it either hasn't done in the past or it hasn't done with the frequency to be truly expert in its delivery and implementation. That's an example of a place where we should turn to the private sector. And with $500 billion of product and services purchased every year by government, I see this goal that we're talking about here essentially moving the balance, certainly not eliminating the role that the private sector plays. On the other hand, I believe there have been instances where we have turned to the private sector to provide jobs that are considerably more expensive on a per unit basis with every intention of doing them forever. And that doesn't make sense. And that is particularly true in areas that are inherently governmental, like policy, where people are making judgments. And if you have that skill shortage and you're a new COO and you come on board, gee, I need five people to work that issue, and you can't find that individual, again, see the human capital piece, because you didn't train, develop, provide the educational opportunities and so on, so they don't have the skills. You need those skills, and you turn to the private sector and you bring that in. That's a good thing. But what we should be doing is investing in people over time so that we have that capability and those can be government jobs. I think at the end of the day, we have not looked at the net present value, that is the value net of cost, of looking at these jobs over 5 or 10 years. And we need to apply that financial metric, and we need to think, look, if this job is going to be part of what it means to deliver services continuously in government over decades, why should that job be in the private sector where you're paying a 30 or 40% premium on a per-unit basis? So he asked me to sort of give an example where we're doing that. And everyone knows at the VA we hire about 20,000 doctors, about 60,000 nurses, big group. We also buy $3.5 billion worth of services outside VA for specialized care. It's an area where I think we need to look, have we brought those physicians into the VA fold, and do we have that right mix between contract medical services and in-house medical services?
Thank you. Let's open the microphones to questions from the audience. Yes, sir, you're at the ready.
Naval Research Laboratory. You've begun discussing the culture changes needed in handling human capital. We're in the midst of several complex crises. Presidential Decision Directive 56 is on managing complex contingency operations, although it does exclude domestic disaster relief, hostage rescue operations, and international armed conflict. My questions are, how do we reform to distribute responsibility and engender flexible interactions between agencies, including with and within DOD? How do we accomplish the overall reforms needed for our addressing current and future frequently poorly defined challenges? And most importantly, how do we reform to grow innovative people and empower them?
Wow, who wants to take that?
I'll start. Sure. I think that one of the things that we're hearing from President Obama that we fully embrace at USDA is the issue of transparency. And I think that's part of it, that we all need to be more transparent in our decision-making processes, in the work that we do, and bring people outside of government into conversation with us as we steer the ship. I think that will go a great deal to some of the issues that are embedded in your questions. And I also think we need to, in that conversation, social media, we need to be transparent. I also am confronted with advisory committees at USDA. I'm not even sure how many, by the way. Well over 300, probably at least $8 million a year we're spending on advisory committees. A lot of them are statutorily established, but we actually fly people into Washington or wherever, the Chicago Airport Hotel, and we have 14 people or 20 people on an advisory committee, and some people are leaving the farms to do this, and then they have to hire labor, and it's a real sacrifice. But I'm not sure how we're taking in that advice. I don't know if all these committees are critical, and I don't know if they really meet today's needs. I mean, we could do a web-based discussion on critical issues, get a wider participation. People could come in and out. So, again, how do we have a conversation with those outside of the government about where we're going? I think that we have a lot of new opportunities at hand.
Jump in at a second level here in terms of the interagency process. Everybody in the room here, a manager and supervisor, you have a list of kind of operating principles that you use to manage well. Secretary Shinseki has one that I'm very fond of. It's who else needs to know? Who else needs to know? That question applied on an interagency basis is what we need to do with each other and what we understand we need to be doing to realize the president's agenda and vision of having government that's truly transparent, accountable, and responsible to citizens. So like Kathleen's experience in the budget process where she asked in her own organization who else is doing this, we're beginning to have that experience now, I know, with Seth on veterans education and training, where you realize that you've got an ally in the process with extraordinary resources and people that need to be combined and delivered to accomplish the results. The second part of the gentleman's question here had to do with how do you grow the people to do that? You train them, you challenge them, you develop them. I was 21 years old when I took over a division at sea with 30 people in it. Now, my chief petty officer will tell you I didn't know much, but I was challenged early on. I believe that happens all across government in the civilian sector. All right, it happens with our people. They get enormous responsibility. This is the thing we need to be talking about, and then we need to support those new graduates from college and master's degree programs and so forth with training and development and investment over time so that they can become the leaders of the future.
Yeah, I would just add one thought to that about how you grow those people is that you model the behavior. There are certain things that you can't teach in a classroom, and I think that interdepartmental, interagency, even intradepartmental interagency problem solving is the kind of behavior that you can only learn through modeling and participation. And one of the things that I have found particularly helpful in my short tenure as the deputy is that I have personal relationships with Kathleen and Scott and others in the government. So I'm able to turn to them sort of offline a little bit and say, how are you doing X, Y, and Z? Or shouldn't we be talking about A, B, and C? And it's been the grease that has smoothed the path for our organizations to come together, for me to learn what I need to learn. Again, that's not the kind of thing that you can teach in a classroom. It's the kind of thing that develops over time in an environment. So the challenge, my view, is the challenge to some extent isn't the White House. It's for the White House to foster that kind of environment across all the agencies, to not become insular themselves, but to engage us and to have systems, but not especially formal systems, that bring us all together. And I think they're beginning to do that, and they're becoming more and more successful at that. You know, they're dealing with crisis after crisis after crisis also. It's hard to think about process when you're absorbed with, when you're overwhelmed with substance all the time, but I think that they're doing a better and better job at that as well.
Out of OMB, probably.
OMB is one of the locations, but the policy councils, I think, are also playing a very important role in that.
I would observe that these are what you're describing is a little bit ad hoc, and that maybe especially with regard to coordination of programs among the agencies, it needs to be more institutionalized, perhaps. But think about that while we take our next question here.
My name is Gretchen Lehman, and I'm from the Department of Health and Human Services. And one comment on interagency work is that I think that that goes back to Congress and the way appropriations are done with committees in Congress as well. And I think that the executive branch tries to do a lot of those things, but we have to get them on board with some of the, especially with the specific programs that they're giving each agency and getting things combined. Anyway, first of all, I'd just like to say, Dr. Merrigan, I am so happy that you are where you are. I don't work on food policy in my job, but as a personal interest, some of the things that you've said lately about fresh food and getting things to school cafeterias and changing the whole way that kids eat, I'm just thrilled to have you where you are. I was thinking as the discussion was going on about you're all very optimistic about these changes, and I'm glad that you are. Having been in government for about 2 years, I'm a little more cynical, even though it's only 2 years. And particularly, you know, Deputy Secretary Harris, when you were talking about the inevitability of the cultural changes of bringing, you know, recent graduates, people in their 20s and 30s, the inevitability of those changes, I'm not seeing that yet, and I'm not sure that it's going to happen fast enough not to lose some of those people again. And I, especially looking at the seeing these people and investing in them, and I wonder about, you know, you're all, obviously you have to be very positive about the staff that you have inherited, but there are people, not everyone, and it's not necessarily generational, but there are a lot of people who are invested in the systems that we have, and they're invested in doing the same thing that they've been doing for the last 15 years and not seeing that dramatically change. And so I'm wondering, how do you either work to bring those people on board to change these systems, or how do you work to get them out and to bring on people who are willing to make changes? So I'm wondering how you... And maybe you see other challenges, but so feel free to talk about other challenges that you see with implementing this. But I would like to hear a little more realism about how we address these ingrained systematic problems.
You know, I appreciate that comment. I'm not naive about it at all. I don't view the changes as being inevitable. I don't think merely hiring 20 and 30-somethings who start Twittering each other and using Flickr is going to change the way the Labor Department does business. The challenge for us is twofold. One is to listen and to engage our employees at every level in a discussion about how we best accomplish our mission. And that was what I meant to say in my discussion of how we engage our unions. The discussion with the unions and with employees who are members of the unions has to be not merely about what their work life's about, but what their work is about. And because I think that, at least with respect to the Labor Department, I don't want to speak for any other department, is that the satisfaction that employees get from their work life is a function of, in part, of how they... how much they feel they're contributing to the mission of the agency. So we have to be, one thing that we have to do is when we bring these folks in, and even with the folks that are currently on board, is we have to be much, much more effective about listening. I'm actually engaged in a dialogue on an open government blog that we created, an internal open government blog. And the first reaction that we got from folks on the blog, and we asked a bunch of questions about how can we do our business better, how can we use information technology, what do we do with social media and other things, and the first reaction was, boy, this is great. Posting after posting after posting, this is great, this is so terrific. And to the point where I had to go on the blog and say, thank you very much, but now give us your ideas. So there's an eagerness for engagement because I think folks really want to do the best they can do. Again, just speaking for my folks. The second is to create systems that assure ladders to leadership. Right? So if we get a 20-something or a 30-something who we hire as a frontline investigator in wage and hour, they've got to see a path to leadership, and we've got to set up a system that assures that in order to succeed in that system, they don't have to give up everything that makes them a wonderful contributor to the organization. And I understand that that's difficult. All of these organizations within the Labor Department have their own cultures, and there's an expectation that you're going to perform in a particular way. My hope is, and this may be a vain hope, but my hope is that to the extent we can focus discussion on outcomes and mission, that we can be less systems-focused, less input-focused, because that's really where you get into a logjam. When you're fighting about, I want to do it this way, no, we've always done it that way, you're not really producing, a productive change. If we can talk about what the outcomes are and we can come to agreement as to what the values are and we can agree about what we're really trying to do, I think that discussion becomes a lot easier and there's an openness in the organization that results. We'll see. You know, we'll see. Let's have another conversation in 2 years and see if all the life has been beaten out of me.
Go ahead, Kathleen.
So let me just say, in this budget priority-based results-based budgeting exercise, you know, I've got a lot of people who've been around town a long time, and they're rolling their eyes. Merrigan, what are you thinking? Are you new to the town? Are you new to the scene? And I told them a little vignette from David Osborne's book, The Price of Government. And there was a guy who came to the meeting, and he wore a placard around his neck that said, suspend disbelief. And I like to believe this whole administration, in a way, is about that. We're optimistic. We're not going to believe that can't be done. We're here at the starting gates. We're going great guns, and we're going to make some things happen.
I just add, hang in there. As somebody we're working for once said, you're the change that you see. I think that leadership is key to this. We're in a battle for the hearts and minds of 3,000 GS-14s, 15s, and SES as a starter, and then the other 288,000 folks in the VA. I think that happens through encouragement and reward. It happens through training. It happens through personal example. And it happens through change management and strategic communications. We've got to use all those tools, and the good thing is we've got them. And we have bosses who believe that this needs to be done.
You know, I think that's a good place to end, with apologies to the people who are still waiting to ask questions. Maybe you can ask them after we wrap up here, but we want to be respectful of people's time. Let me offer a great deal of thanks to Seth, Kathleen, and Scott for joining us here today. And please join me in giving them a round of applause.
Thank you. I did too.